just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek, brought to you by the Rock Creek Free Press.
Hello. Yesterday, my wife and I celebrated our 27th anniversary. A lot of things have happened in that 27 years. Two that stick in my mind were the space shuttle disasters. I remember being at work with my fellow programmers in Baltimore. My friend Jeff came in and said, Challenger just blew up. Columbia had her turn as center of attention more recently. While I think the first was bad management, I'm pretty sure the second was more sinister. Of course, only a handful of people died in the shuttles, compared to 3,000 or more claimed by the 9/11 disaster. We tend to think in numbers about these things. We tend to think that 3,000 is 300 times worse than 10. But to each victim's family, the number could have been 1. It would have been just as bad. Speaking of numbers and anniversaries, some 4,439 Americans have died in the Iraq War that we started 8 years ago, this March 19th. At my mom's church, they asked us to pray for the American soldiers in Iraq. I've stopped going. I don't see why I should be praying exclusively for the invaders. Seems to me the people that live there have the worst end of the deal. If numbers are what matter, well, the Iraqi deaths are at least 25 times more important, and by other counts, 250 times more important. Well, I don't think numbers are the big thing now. It only takes one death for it to be important, and we need to stop the killing. And now, let me introduce my co-host, Mike Pelichek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we have with us our special guest is Victor Thorne, and our guest poet is Mike Maggio. We are very excited to have them with us tonight from State College, Pennsylvania, and Herndon, Virginia. So hello, everyone out there from Fort Lauderdale, State College, Herndon, and Duluth. The New American Dream, it's not about pulling more stuff into our pile. It's about actually becoming the quality of people we have always imagined ourselves to be. We're not there yet, but let's get a little bit closer right now. Say if we tossed every sophomore history book in the nation in the dumpster, that would create jobs to haul the dumpster somewhere, and then have the kids instead watch Waco, The Rules of Engagement, The 1%. The 1% is a movie by an heir to the Johnson & Johnson fortune, and he really shows some courage talking to his own family, and he explores the great divide we have between the rich and poor in this country. And then I suggest Loose Change. And also there's a movie online that you can see called The Oklahoma City Bombing, What Really Happened. I would say forget about George Washington and the cherry tree. I'm sure most of us already have, but there's other forms of the myth that we still believe in. If you really want to be a true American, you need to know who Barry Jennings was, Oklahoma City police officer Terry Yakey. You need to wonder why Timothy McVeigh seemingly went to his death so easily. You need to question whether 9/11 was not done by 19 guys with box cutters. What has the CIA done in other countries in our names, but really in the service of those with money? You need to wonder what happened to Gary Webb after he wrote a story about CIA drug running in Los Angeles. It was a story that ran in the San Jose Mercury News when the Webb was first getting going. And I remember reading that when we got America Online, and I thought, wow, I thought it was really it. It was going to be a great period in American media, but maybe it was just that story that they had to shut it down. The media is worse than a junior high newsletter, I would say now. There's also reason to believe we did not go to the moon and that the government has been withholding information about UFOs. And sure, there is a possibility that some so-called conspiracy theories are only that. But it can never, never be argued that we should not ask these questions. At least in the Soviet Union, when they saw nonsense and lies printed in Pravda and TASS, at least they knew they were lies. And we are still in the infancy stage in our development of believing the lies. We clip out the lies and attach them to our refrigerator doors with American flag magnets. I once wrote a book called Looking for Bigfoot. Looking for Bigfoot was about a guy from Iowa who went on a bus trip, and he was going to find his high school baseball coach, but he was also looking for the truth about America. And, you know, truth about the different assassinations and truth about our history. I think that's very important. That's at the core of what the new American dream is about. Bigfoot is real. Bigfoot is real. JFK, RFK, MLK were not killed by lone nuts. And each one of the millions of high school history books in the bottoms of millions of lockers are make-believe. That's really who we are. And so the next time there is a bombing or a threat of a bombing or a bunch of blue backpacks found in Bemidji, the healthy American, the true American, the real American thinks CIA, FBI, the police. The real patriot refuses to stand for the national anthem. And rather than say the Pledge of Allegiance, he says, not until I get some questions answered, because this is important stuff. They want us to be afraid of seeking out the truth. We cannot be afraid.
Rock Creek gently flows through the parkland of Washington, D.C., until it meets the mighty Potomac River in the heart of the federal city. On the other hand, Rock Creek Free Press is a fiercely independent newspaper that's not afraid to print the truth. We print the stories that others won't touch. The 9/11 cover-up, media propaganda, government corruption, state terrorism, and violations of our constitutional rights. The Creek is a completely reader-supported publication. We accept no corporate advertising, no corporate influence. For a free, no-obligation issue of The Creek, just go to rockcreekfreepress.com. If you want copies for your local 9/11 truth group, send your request to editor@rockcreekfreepress.com. Rock Creek Free Press, not afraid to print the truth.
And now, back to the show with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
Okay, in the Kansas City Star recently, there was a story about nuclear weapons upgrading. There's a new nuclear weapons plant being constructed in Kansas City, and I wanted to talk about that just a little bit. This story was published February 26 in the Kansas City Star by Donald Bradley. I'll just read a quick portion. The construction site of the new billion-dollar Honeywell plant in South Kansas City is quite the head-turner. Workers everywhere, trucks scurrying about like mice, monster earth movers, cranes reaching to the sky, and enough trailers to start a retirement community, all on 185 acres inside a perimeter fence and under a wind-whipped old glory. But drive past the former bean field on Missouri 150 enough times and the thought occurs, Kansas City produces parts for every nuclear weapon now in our arsenal. The country is making more nuclear bombs, has been building them virtually nonstop for 65 years, hasn't used one against an enemy since 1945, and a significant new arms reduction treaty went into effect just last month. 9,000 warheads, about a quarter capable of being triggered tomorrow, is a lot of product sitting around. Any is too many, critics said. Modernization is a joke, just more of the world-threatening same old madness. The $85 billion upgrade of our bomb-making infrastructure in Kansas City with Honeywell and other locations is occurring 50 years after President Dwight Eisenhower warned in his farewell address of the military-industrial complex and its potential for disaster rise from this place power. It's also taking place 2 years after President Barack Obama told the world in a speech in Prague, Czech Republic, that the U.S. was committed to ridding itself of nuclear weapons. And to read the full article, go to Kansas City Star, kansascity.com. The title again is U.S. Trims Its Nuclear Arsenal While Upgrading Production. It's by Donald Bradley.
From Deborah Sweet at The World Can't Wait. On March 2nd, the U.S. military announced 22 more charges against Bradley Manning, the accused Army private imprisoned in solitary confinement since May 2010. One of the new charges, aiding the enemy, is potentially punishable with death. This is the most outrageous development, echoing months of the mouths of right-wingers screaming for his death. Word comes that Brad is now held naked overnight, forced to stand at attention. What was it? Let me interrupt the story for a second. What was it that Brad did? Basically, he saw inhumane, illegal, and illicit treatment of Iraqi civilians by Iraqi authorities. He tried to report it through channels, and then he didn't shut up about it when he was told to. So for standing up, defending the freedom of others, Bradley Manning may be facing the death penalty if he doesn't quietly die first. Fred and David House told MSNBC, Manning's demeanor, the last time he saw him, was as if he had just woken up and didn't know what was going on around him. Manning was utterly exhausted, physically and mentally. It was difficult to have any kind of social engagement. Back to the story. The system holding him is nakedly unjust. The charges themselves expose the extent to which the U.S. military is spread across the world, involved in actions with names like Operation Hammer, detailed in tens of thousands of reports stored in the Internet. Not the first to point out the irony that the Obama administration offered praise, growing fainter every day, to those protesting in streets in Egypt and Tunisia, with outrage fueled by the very revelations that Manning faces death for exposing. These new charges only increase our anger at the treatment of Bradley Manning. It grows clearer by the day how much blood's on the hands of those who accuse him. The very day the charges were being signed, March 1st, 9 children were killed by U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Why do they shoot and kill children? Kathy Kelly, who goes to Afghanistan, wrote, families rely on their children to collect fuel for heat during the harsh winters for cooking year-round. Young laborers wanting to help their families survive mean no harm to the United States. They're not surging at us or anywhere. They're not insurgents. They're not doing anything to threaten us. They're children. Children anywhere, like children everywhere. They're children like our own. All of this argues for a large and determined protest on Sunday, March 20th, outside the brig at Quantico, Virginia, where Manning's imprisoned. There's a rally to support the WikiLeaks whistleblower, Army PFC Bradley Manning, March 20th. Supporters will gather for a 2 p.m. rally at the town of Triangle, then march to the gates of Quantico Marine Corps Base. Bradley's been held at Quantico in solitary conditions for 6 months. We stand for truth, government transparency, and an end to our occupation wars. We stand with Bradley. And the day before, on Saturday, March 19th in Washington, D.C., there's a noon rally at Lafayette Park and march on the White House to resist the war machine. Interject another personal note here. Years back in Vietnam times, I marched on Washington, and my mom did too. My mom actually got tear gassed in front of the White House. That's just a little personal note. Anyway, the protest to stop these wars on March 19th. A war begun on the basis of monstrous lies against a country weakened already by 15 years of sanctions that brought tremendous loss of civilian life.
And there are other protests around the country on March 19th. These are just a few. In San Francisco, collateral murder street showings all week long. Washington, D.C., the We Are Not Your Soldiers tour brings anti-war veterans and activists into high schools, spreading the reality of these wars and much-needed resistance among youth. National protest in Washington, D.C., Saturday, March 19th, 12 noon at the White House. In San Francisco, Saturday, March 19th, 12 noon at Union Plaza, that's 7th and Market. In Los Angeles, Saturday, March 19th, rally and march will gather at 12 noon at Hollywood and Vine. In Chicago, Saturday, March 19th, rally and march at 12 noon at Michigan and Congress. There are more protest events posted at answercoalition.org and unitedforpeace.org.
And that's the way it is. March 10th, 2011.
I'd like now to welcome our guest poet, Mike Maggio, from Herndon, Virginia. Mike has published fiction, poetry, travel, and reviews in Potomac Review, the Montserrat Review, Pleiades, Appalachian Quarterly, the Northern Virginian Review, the LA Weekly, the Washington City Paper, Beltway Quarterly, Pig Iron, DC Poets Against the War, and others. His books include Your Secret is Safe with Me, Oranges from Palestine, Sifting Through the Madness, and Democracy. Mike is an assistant adjunct professor at Northern Virginia Community College and a graduate of George Mason University's MFA program in creative writing. He lives in Herndon, Virginia with his wife and children. Mike, hello, how are you doing? It's a long way to Virginia from here, so we have to kind of shout, right?
Yes. And we need to shout and shout like the people in Wisconsin are shouting.
You're absolutely right. I wanted to ask you first. You teach creative writing, and you how long have you been a poet? Are you also a novelist too? I would imagine.
Yes, I've been a poet for I guess about 20, 25 years. I have written a novel. I write lots of short stories. And currently I'm teaching a class in literature.
I always like to ask writers or poets what caused them to go down the hole of becoming a writer. What caused you to needed to write?
It's a way of... I always felt more comfortable expressing myself in writing than I did verbally, mm-hmm. Because I can organize my thoughts much more clearly and much more succinctly than I can when I'm speaking. Mm-hmm. I think that's the primary reason why I turned to writing.
I can understand that. I sometimes when I don't know how I feel about something myself, if I sit down and write, I find out how I feel about it. I also wanted to ask you about the, you mentioned Wisconsin, and, I was wondering, do you think there's any connection between Egypt and Wisconsin? That might be a stretch, but I just want to throw it out there.
Well, in a way, there is a connection. The people of Egypt are fighting for their rights, as are the people in many countries right now in the Middle East. And that's what we're doing here. Now, we thought we had these rights, and suddenly they're being taken away from us. It's not really that sudden. It started with the Reagan administration, but it's certainly hitting home right now in Wisconsin, in Indiana, in Ohio, and it's quite frightening, quite frankly.
I saw something on Al Jazeera. Oh, it's been a couple weeks ago, but I was kind of surprised to see it. It was a TV show or a TV announcer talking to some people who had said that the revolution had been inspired by poets and novelists, and I thought that was pretty cool. And I wanted to ask you if you think that
you're breaking up. I can hardly hear you.
Okay. What I wanted to ask was I said that I had heard on the internet that the writers and poets in Egypt had been kind of the inspiration for some of the protesters, and I was just wondering if you think that anything that poets and writers in the U.S. could ever be an inspiration to any type of a revolution over here. Sometimes it seems that we don't have much of an influence, but maybe there's hope. What do you think?
Well, I think there's great hope. If you go back to the 60s, we had a lot of poets that were quite vocal and quite effective in influencing public opinion. And some of the ones I can think of, course, are Ginsberg and Ferlinghetti and, of course, Denise Levertov. And there are many others. Gwendolyn Brooks was also quite influential. So I think poets... have a great influence. Our main problem is getting heard, and we're not always heard.
Mike, could you take some time to read us a few of your poems and tell us about them, the inspiration and background, if you care to?
Yes, I prepared three poems that I'm hopefully I'll have time to read. They are from my recent collection called Democracy, which was inspired by the Bush administration, of all things, and the war on Iraq. And the first poem, I'm going to dedicate all these poems to the Wisconsin 14 and to the Union men and women who are fighting the union busting across this country. The first poem is actually a poem about the demonstration that we held in the National Mall prior to the invasion of Iraq. And I think it's quite apropos for what's going on in Wisconsin right now. It's called January 18th, 2003, The People. The people came by bus, on foot. They showed up by train. They hiked the long walk from Iowa. They commuted in the crowded cars of the D.C. Metro. They flew in by plane. They arrived from Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Oregon. They came from Maine and Vermont, from New York and Ohio. From every corner they converged on the center of this mighty, mighty land. They came to speak, to listen, to chant, to shout. United, we the people came in the cold of January, 200,000 strong and still coming. On this day, the day of the birth of our hero, the king, in the winter of a nation whose furnaces crave to be fed, whose furnaces burnish the rich and powerful, while those in the street are forced to rub their toes for warmth. And the people shouted, no blood for oil. And the banners pleaded, money for jobs, not war. We stood in the cold, united, some naked, some numb, some banging on drums and timpanis. Together, young and old, we warmed ourselves in ideals and slogans. We warmed ourselves up to oppose the bald, arrogant orders, to reject a war of massive aggression, to expose their weapons of mass deception and unmask their empty warheads. And the people shouted, blessed are the peacemakers. Because united, we, the people, will never be beaten again. We, the people, will never be hamstrung and trodden again. Because we, the people, who voted for a winner, were crowned the ultimate losers. Because we, the people, having been kidnapped by democracy, were drawn and quartered by the marketing kings, the TV tyrants, the precinct persecutors, by the callous courtroom kangaroos, who had our chads ripped out, we whose tongues have been dissected, whose voices shackled in the name of democracy, in this democracy of all democracies, we came to speak. Defeated, in the name of America we come, united, we the people from all over this great land, to pledge allegiance to the nation for which we stand, licked by cold and bluster. We shout, and we will shout, and the world will shout for liberty and justice for all. And the voices in the streets saying, the people united will never be defeated. The people united will never be defeated. We, the people, will never be defeated. We, the people, will never again be defeated. And the next poem I'd like to read is called My Job. I had it. Yes, it's called My Job. My job went a-walking up Wall Street. My job came a-crawling back down. My job spit me in a fearsome eye. My job say, what you gonna do when we send you home? My job sing, what you gonna say? Oh yeah, oh yeah. My job works double-ass for single-ass pay. My job is to get off welfare. My job is to stay employed. My job is to get laid off. My job is to beg for my doodah rights. My job is dead. My job, doo-wah, doo-wah. My job went a-wishing and a-washing. My job returned empty-handed. My job went up the river and never came back. Oh, my job. My job to spend when the man say. My job to save when the man say. My job to get into doodah debt. My job to pay it all off. My job to make the economy, oh my, it's all on me. On me, on my job. Now let me tell you something. My job is not to feed you, your economy. My job is not to spend. My job is not to accept your paltry pittance. My job is down home scary. My job is to survive, sir. Now listen to my story. Now listen to me good. My job is pissing on your street. My job is sleeping on your bench. My job is eating your scraps like a catfish dog. My job is to wreak my stench all over Prissy Park Place. Oh my, oh my. My job traveled overseas. My job went 6 feet underground. My job walked away like an ungrateful bitch. My job laughs at me on a ticker tape. My job teeters from an Eiffel Tower. My job trickles from your penthouse suite. Do you like me now? Do you like it? My job is counting crow. My job is to reckon the lies on your spineless back. My job sucks your blue shit blood. My job rages through your deepest fears. Now let me entertain you. My job is electric barbed wire. My job is to riot through your prison. My job is not to sizzle on your doo-dah chair. My job is to rap-rap-a-tat-tat on your whitewashed door. My job is to look you from a glass eye and shout, doo-dah. And I don't know if I have time for one more.
I think probably not.
Try.
So, well, sorry about that, Mike, but I guess we have to keep moving. But I want to thank you, and I want to invite you to come back again soon. And we really enjoyed them. Is there any projects or new appearances that you want to tell us about before going?
Yes, let's see. I have been involved in some performance poetry projects recently. One of them is called Cloudism. And we are going to be presenting that at the Capitol Fringe Fest in D.C. this summer. So if anybody's in D.C. during July, I invite you to come and see that. And I do have a novel which I'm trying to publish. And Democracy is available for sale. You can get it from Plainview Press. Or you can visit my website, mikemaggio.net, and purchase it from there. And I can... you an autographed copy. So I thank you for inviting me, and hope you enjoyed it.
For coming on, and I'm sorry to cut you off so short, and I hope you'll come back again soon.
Thank you.
Yep, bye.
If you're a good American, with all the poking and probing, you might well be asking yourself, am I a terrorist? Well, the Center for American Studies has put together a handy brochure now available in most U.S. interstate rest areas. It's called Mommy, Am I a Terrorist? Some excerpts. If you're driving past a policeman in the United States, you might be a terrorist. If your Reader's Digest subscription expired, you might be a terrorist. If you order a salad, oh, you might be a terrorist. If you're walking down the street, you might be a terrorist. If your American flag on your front porch, flapping in the spring breeze, is not larger than a goddamn circus tent, you might be a terrorist. If you're directing by remote control from the portico off the Rose Garden while smoking a cigarette surreptitiously in your pajamas, a drone airplane that hits the home of a family in a small town in Pakistan and rips their arms and legs from their bodies, their heads from their shoulders, forever destroys the lives of their extended family as well, well, you might be a terrorist.
Tonight's show is also being sponsored by the classic hit TV show Dancing with the Stars, the Stanley Kubrick movie of the Apollo moon landings. Yeah, we went to the moon. It was on TV right after My Favorite Martian and before Bewitched. It was real. Get over it. Dancing with the Stars, because we know if it's on TV, it's reality. And also by a grant from Warm and Fuzzy Smallpox Blankets of Muncie, Indiana. Made in the USA, good old American know-how. Smallpox blankets, drone airplanes, anthrax, and nuclear weapons, bombs, bullets, fighter planes, our products. Welcome to life in the 21st century America, where our products are death, destruction, low-paying jobs, and the tossing overboard of the poor, sick, and elderly, all to support the war racket. Made in the USA, making America strong, keeping our neighborhoods strong and our churches strong, our car dealerships strong and our country clubs strong. Warm and fuzzy, smallpox blankets of Muncie. Also, we're being sponsored by Lone Nutter's breakfast cereal. Look for the big box and the empty insides. There's lots of hot air in Lone Nutter's. You're going to love it. Produced and packaged by the American propaganda machine, Battle Creek, Michigan. And finally, make sure to check out starring in the new hit movie, Barack Obama, Special Agent 00 of Change. He flies, no, he crawls. He speaks, no, he lies. He saves the people, he does great things. No, he doesn't. Barack Obama, Special Agent 00, in theaters now, or not. And this public service announcement brought to you by Rolaids and the American Spelling Bee Council of Bowling Green. How do you spell Al-Qaeda? Can you use that in a sentence, please? Yes. Al-Qaeda, the evil towel heads who drove the planes into the towers in the Pentagon. And now we have to take our clothes off to fly in an airplane, and they do more stuff every day, it seems, and we are scared of them, so we don't care if we have freedom of speech or nothing. Because we are Americans, and we have car racing, and we can still kill animals, and we have our guns to keep us safe from deer and elk. And we really don't know our elbows from our behinds, because we want our guns, and we salute the troops and the flags and the parades and say, way to go killing those kids in the mountains over there, because it was Bush who did 9/11 and not those kids, and we really don't know nothing. The word origin, please? Evil. How do you spell Al-Qaeda? Is it A-L-Q-U-A-D-A? A-L-K-A-Y-D-A? A-L-Q-A-E-D-A? A-L-Q-A-I-D-A? E-L-Q-U-E-D-A? We spell it C-I-A every time.
Now I'd like to welcome our special guest, Victor Thorne. He's the founder of Sisyphus Press, co-host of Wing TV from 2003 to 2006. And the author of numerous books, including The New World Order Exposed, 9/11 on Trial, and the book we're going to talk about some tonight, Phantom Flight 93. Victor, welcome to our show.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's a real pleasure.
I have your book here in front of me. Can you tell us a little bit about it, when it came out,
Phantom Flight 93, it was published by American Free Press, which I also am a weekly writer for, and this is still, to my knowledge, the only conspiracy book written about Flight 93, which, in my opinion, is the real smoking gun of 9/11. Most of the attention, of course, has been paid to the World Trade Center towers and, to a lesser extent, the Pentagon. But almost no attention has been paid to Flight 93. And once anyone delves into this, they realize what a fairy tale, what the real conspiracy theory on 9/11 was actually concocted by the government. And when you look into this event down in the southeast corner of Pennsylvania, you realize ultimately that this Boeing 757 did not crash land in Shanksville, this abandoned strip mine, like the government said that it did.
Among the questions, where did the passengers go? Where did the plane go, for that matter? There really aren't any remains of that plane, are there?
Well, here's what you have to look at, first of all, to start off with. Whenever I engage in an investigation, you go right back to the basics. So Flight 93 was a Boeing 757, and the dimensions of this is that it weighed 255,000 pounds. It was 150 feet long and had 124-foot wingspan. Now, everybody that was on the scene on the morning of September 11, 2001, who actually witnessed what they called the crater, and these were state police officers, various media outlets, search and rescue people, and eyewitnesses from the local community, describe a crater that was anywhere from 8 to 10 feet deep to, at best, 24 foot wide. Now, there was no evidence whatsoever of fuselage, of engines, of wings, of passengers, luggage, of clothing, anything there. And anyone that goes onto the internet and looks for photos of this crater realizes that one thing that's always in common in every airplane crash is that there's wreckage. Whether it's a jumbo jet, whether it's a military jet, or whether it's a small prop plane, whenever a plane crashes, there's always, always, always wreckage. But when you look at this crater, all you see is a 10-foot wide hole or a 20-foot wide hole that's 10 feet deep. How can a plane that weighs a quarter of a million pounds fit into this little 10-foot deep crater and there's no wreckage whatsoever? So the first thing you realize is that the plane didn't crash there. And in the book, Phantom Flight 93, which is also available at wingtv.net, you realize that the plane didn't crash there. And there's eyewitnesses accounts by people there that morning that tends us to, you know, real good evidence that instead of a plane crashing there, this was actually a missile shot into the ground that was used as a diversion. Now, there are some ultimate questions. What happened to the plane? What happened to the passengers? And to this day, 10 years later, almost 10 years later, nobody knows the answers to that. But on that morning, CNN, a reporter named Brian Cabell, was in a little town called New Baltimore, which I visited prior to writing this book, and he reported that there was a second debris field found 6 to 8 miles away. Now, was the plane shot down? Donald Rumsfeld said it was, but again, was this more subterfuge? Was this another red herring that was used to divert people? So there's a lot of big questions that are out there, but this book, Phantom Flight 93, is the only one yet that's actually confronted them, and it's the only book of its kind out there to address, which, like I said, is the biggest smoking gun of 9/11.
I know there was a movie sometime back about that flight, and you pretty well debunked that movie in one of the chapters in the book.
Right, yeah, I went and saw that movie, and what this movie did was that it tried to perpetuate the reasoning that was given ever since September 11th, that the reason that this attack happened by these supposed 19 Arab cave dwellers was mere incompetence on the part of the U.S. government. That, you know, at no other time in the history of our nation, especially in the last 20 years or so, it's the only time ever that our military completely stood down, that all the protocols that had been in place for decades, none of them were followed, and on and on and on. The air traffic controllers failed. Every single institute and agency that morning, everybody was suddenly struck by incompetence. And that's what this movie really perpetuated in was supposed to perpetuate in the audience's mind, was that this was just a big cluster, that nobody knew what was going on, and the Al-Qaeda, they hijacked the planes and they slipped through, and all my, you know, they just happened to get away with it. So yeah, it was a really feeble attempt at propaganda is what it was. And, you know, to most people unaware, they might watch this movie and walk away and say, oh, okay, that's what happened. But anyone that studies the subject, they weren't fooled for even a second.
You've actually visited the crash scene, or the so-called crash scene for Flight 93. I guess that's probably, it's almost local for you, probably a couple hundred miles.
Yeah, it's about 2 hours away from here, and we went down there and spent 3 days. And by the time we left, we were undoubtedly the most marked people in town. And when we started talking to everyday people, they were more apt to agree that none of the facts added up. But the higher you went up through the food chain, we went and talked to state police officers, to the coroner, Wally Miller, to news reporters, and on down the line. We went and spoke to somebody right at the crash site, who is the administrator of sorts. And the higher you got and the more official type people we spoke to, the more closed mouth they got, and the more they started spreading the word that, hey, there are these people in town asking questions, and they absolutely didn't want us down there, and they absolutely didn't want us asking these questions because none of it adds up, and it's almost as if there was this entire myth that covered the area, and they put out this one official story, and everyone was supposed to believe it, hook, line, and sinker, and they didn't want anyone coming in and say, look, the emperor has no clothes, and that's what we were doing. So, you know, by the time we left, they certainly wanted to run us out of town and didn't want anything to do with us, but it was very eye-opening to actually see firsthand the way a myth is created. And it's once people are given this Kool-Aid and told to drink it, they're all supposed to walk in lockstep to this sanctioned story, and we threw a monkey wrench into it.
Well, keep up that good work. I'm afraid that we're out of time, but I'd like to know what you're working on now, if you have anything to share with us that we should be looking for from you.
Right, on wingtv.net, I just published a book that came out last week. It's called New World Order Assassins. Also, last week, another little book I wrote called Conspiracy Hall of Fame. So those both came out last week. And then in conjunction with the 10th anniversary of 9/11, probably this August, I'll publish a 10th anniversary edition. It's an update of 9/11 Evil, and this is going to be called Made in Israel, the Jewish Plot Against America. And it closes the argument about Jewish involvement in 9/11. It absolutely proves definitively that 9/11 wasn't orchestrated by Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, but instead was orchestrated by the Nation of Israel in conjunction with elements within the U.S. government.
Wow. Well, we'll have to look for those. Thank you for joining us, and we hope to have you again sometime.
Okay, I'd love to come back on. Thank you very much.
Well, it's been a long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. The last time we left Charlie Johnson, he was being driven by his niece to the mental hospital in Mount Liberty to get a checkup to see why he was writing letters to the editor of the Wednesday Miracle, where he used to work as a sports reporter until he retired. Apparently, his relatives found some of his writings in a worn red folder that he brought with him to Thanksgiving dinner way back when, and ever since then, they've been monitoring him. One of the confiscated pieces read like this.
You couldn't tell by looking at me that I'm a stranger in my hometown. What's it like to walk around my town and be a dissident? Well, let me tell you. Oh, you don't agree with my terminology. You don't like that I use dissident? You prefer unemployed or some other word that would say I'm different? Out of touch, perhaps, because of my own fault? You want me to feel bad about who I am rather than tell you you're the one in the wrong? I won't. Dissident. The word stays. I stay. I'm a social deviant. Well, perhaps. That's what they might call me in a first-year psych course at the community college. Someone not abiding by society's norms and customs. But I'm more than that. I'm someone willing to fight. And for that, I claim political status. There's no embassy for me to run to. I sit alone in my kitchen, drinking reheated coffee. I stamp the cup down on the table and claim it. I write a letter to the editor, and my neighbor looks away even more deeply into his garden as I walk out my door toward the front walk. The mailman is coming. I wait for him. He pulls his truck to a squeaky stop in front of my home. I prepare a quip about the brakes on his buggy. He seems embarrassed to see me. Slips the mail into my hand with a hurried comment on the weather, scurries off. I see I'll have time to refine my joke. I leaf through the mail, stuff it under my arm, then walk down the street looking at the driver of every car that passes. Maybe I know them. Each one stares intently ahead. They're all excellent drivers. I walk downtown into the cafe looking for friendly eyes. My best friend from the high school basketball team. Well, not that I played, but he did. Gives me a kind of nod as he finds a way around me. I decide I'm not hungry, turn to go out. I follow my footprints home. I don't bother to check who's driving past. I don't look to see who's out and about, sitting, standing, gabbing. Staring straight ahead, I walk faster. I pull up to my house just as my neighbor puts a full garbage bag over his shoulder to take to the alley. I don't bother to try to catch his eye. No over-the-shoulder, how you doing, wave. Not this time. Not anymore. I turn in at my house, push inside, drop my mail on the floor by the door, sit in my big chair. I stare straight. I sit there for a few minutes. It gets dark. Been sitting there a long time. And inside my head, inside the brain and heart that belong to me, I've either decided to die or I'm thinking of another letter to the editor. I don't think you could tell by looking at me.
And inside the Mount Liberty State Hospital, Charlie is getting the lay of the land. For now, at least, I didn't have to pee. I sank way down in that chair. It was so soft, so firm, I felt safe. I put the footrest up and reached to the floor out of habit for my Afghan all folded up and washed by June for me, and there was one there. It had a thick weave, the kind with no spaces to let the cold air through, the way I like it. I unfolded it, and for some reason it felt yellow and red like mine. I really am crazy. I distinctly remember the thought crossing my mind. Like a fisherman casting his net, I tossed it at my legs. It took me a couple of tries to get it over my toes, and it was big enough to tuck around my shoulders under my chin. Now I'd really better not have to go, so I sat there. I stared into the dark until it wasn't so dark anymore. I really was not afraid for once. For what reason, I don't know. It had been a long time. At home, after June left, I had the radio or TV on, usually most of the night. I began to make out shapes, directions, sounds, smells, and imagined I heard the cry of someone in the night, maybe being tortured by whips or by thoughts of having taken their child to the first day of school and now looking into the child's room and there was no child at all. The screams came again, and I could not tell if they were from the houses on the shore or the boat out here on the big lawn sea, this floating prison, insane asylum, lifeboat, timeout room, this nesting place for tired minds. Or maybe I heard myself crying. When I wrote all those letters to the editor about how it would cost too much to build another school or how the hippies were ruining America, they never sent me out here. My friends smiled at me when I came to dance for coffee. But when I wrote about the war in Iraq and called Bush a stupid idiot, nobody remembered to save my regular chair. When I was in school, Catholic school, they told us, thou shalt not kill. They told us a lot of things. And then when you go out those side doors and take them seriously, they say, wait a minute, be realistic. You ever ask for directions in a small town, it's always the same. The guy will smile and tell you that you can't miss it, and if you pass the Dairy Queen, you've gone too far. If you're sitting in the mental health institution at night by yourself in the pitch dark with a yellow and red Afghan over your knees, you've probably gone too far. And you know all those things that you hear every day, blah, 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 you're crazy, man. You're going there, you're crazy. You're doing that, then you're crazy. All of these things we can't do or we are crazy. I must have done quite a few. Charlie sat in his chair in the state hospital day room with an Afghan over his legs, remembering another of his letters to the editor, the reason he was all alone.
Sunday afternoon. Dear editor, I have a neighbor across the street. We've watched each other out our front windows for 40 years. Their son played ball in our yard. Last week, that son's body came home in a body bag in a box in the belly of a big plane back from Baghdad. That's nothing to be joking about. I'm not. I will not be quiet either. I've talked to my neighbors since then, on the sidewalk in front of the house, again on the side steps of church after Mass. They say Timothy died because he loved freedom. That's nonsense. He loved basketball. They say he had his head blown off his shoulders, his legs cut off at the knees, lost his hands, in order to make us free. Well, Of course, that's not true, but what else do a heartbroken grandmother and grandfather have to hold on to? Someone needs to speak for Timothy, perhaps speak to him, tell him the truth, because we lied to him his whole life. Timothy died because of us. Me. You. We told him it was good to go. Father Cyril, either by his legendary silence or the flag next to the altar, said it was good to go kill children and call that fighting for freedom. She never met Timothy, but Cindy Sampson, our new editor from Iowa State, told him the same by the story she ran, the headlines and photos and editorial. So patriotic. So deceptive. So self-serving. We all told him, go, go, it's a good thing to do. We whispered, go kill, go shoot, go murder and steal. We'll call it fighting for freedom. When we hear after thousands and thousands have died that there was no reason to die, we'll dig our heels in the front lawn grass and we'll still call it fighting for freedom. When our own grandchildren hit the ball into the graveyard, come back and ask us about the headstone with the flag on it and the same last name is there, who was that? We'll bite our tongues and clench our fists and look anywhere but their trusting eyes. And we'll tell them Timothy died fighting for our freedom.
That's the news from Mount Liberty, Nebraska, where all the police are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the journalists are about average.
And now our profiles and heart segment. To those who have given or are still giving their heart and soul, helping us all have a better world. Our thanks for caring. And if any of these names are not familiar, give them a Google search. Again, our thanks.
Peter DeMott.
Kevin McGuire.
Daryl Rupiper.
Kathy Boylan.
Larry Rosebaugh.
Richard Dolan.
John Boncour, Splitting the Sky.
Howard Zinn.
Tom Lewis.
Norman Mayer.
General Smedley Butler.
We'd like to thank again Rock Creek Free Press for sponsoring our show. And we hope you'll visit our websites, www.newamericandream.net, and the show's website, theshow.newamericandream.info. The show is part of a network where you can buy all of Mike's books. Stop by again next week, same time, same place. Thank you, Mike, and good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Ken Lay. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
Down in Australia when the Waco debacle ended. And I was very bummed because I thought that was the most fascinating story of the year, bar none. And everyone was so upset with that guy because he called himself Jesus, right? And I said, come on, you know, the guy's real name is Vernon. Let him be Jesus for a couple of months. You know what I mean? What's it to you? Who's going to follow a Messiah named Vernon anyway? You got to be Jesus. That's part of the Messiah deal. And Vernon spake. Yeah, yeah. What are we doing? I'm following Vernon. Where y'all going? To the drive-in. Joe Bob Briggs in the movie was real good. Vernon's going. He's my Messiah. He said he'd get us some beef jerky. I follow Vernon. Isn't that weird, though? People always snap and think they're Jesus. How come no one ever snaps and thinks they're Buddha? Particularly in America, where more people resemble Buddha than Jesus. I'm Buddha. You're Buddha.
I'm Buddha now. All I got to do is change two letters on my belt. Bubba, Buddha. Come over here and read my scripture. Vernon's a false prophet. Buddha Bubba's the real man.
But I was in Australia, and the Australians had a big contingency at the Branch Davidian compound, and I'm from Texas, so they were very curious. They were asking me all about it, you know. Oh, this guy's so weird, isn't he? This guy, Koresh, is so weird. And I was thinking, well, wait a minute. Frustrated rock musician with a messianic complex, armed to the teeth, and trying to fuck everything that moves. I don't know how to tell you this. It sounds like every one of my friends in Austin. I don't know if this is going to be an isolated incident. I'm waiting for Will Sexton to build a compound somewhere. I don't even know what that means. I don't even know what. It's an Austin name. I picked it out of a hat. Pick your own Austin guitarist and have fun with the joke. But I thought the whole thing was an absolute disaster and a debacle. And if any of y'all have been watching Public Access and seen the footage, which was not shown on any major news media source of the tanks, Bradley tanks, shooting fire into the compound, which I think went against the party line story, which was that they shot tear gas in order to help the mothers and the children to get out, to convince them, while they're destroying the compound, they're getting the mom and children out. The soft sell is definitely the FBI's way. And anyway, so the major news said that the Branch Davidians started the fire. If I'm not mistaken, correct me when I go off the story here. And that the Branch Davidians started, and all they did was shoot in tear gas. And yet I've seen with my own eyes and my squeegee third eye footage of a Bradley tank shooting fire into the compound, which, isn't that odd that no major news source has picked up on that? How do you think that's newsworthy? Because that basically means that the government, from the FBI, the ATF, up to Janet Reno, including Clinton, are liars and murderers. And wait, there's more. And, I mean, the implications are vast. You know, and if the ATF and FBI had any honor, if there was any honor left or dignity on this planet, they would commit Harry Caray while first admitting what they've done, and they'd kill themselves because they are liars and murderers.
Yeah. Oh, we had to bust the compound down because we heard child molestation was going on. Yeah, if that's true, how come we don't see Bradley tanks knocking down Catholic churches? I'm talking if child molestation is actually your concern. Well, there's a methamphetamine lab on the... No, there wasn't. And not one child came out of there saying they were molested. Not one child. They don't want the voice of reason spoken, folks, because otherwise we'd be free, and otherwise we wouldn't believe their fucking horseshit lies, nor the fucking propaganda machine, the mainstream media, and buy their horseshit products that we don't fucking need and become a third-world consumer fucking plantation, which is what we're becoming. Fuck them. They are liars and murderers. All governments are liars and murderers. And I am now Jesus. Now, this is my compound.